Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by my colleague Phil Bishop, our online news editor. Good morning, Phil.
Hello, David. How are things?
Well, not too bad, but we've had a couple of network problems contacting each other today. Rumour has it might be connected to this virus which is going around, and not a computer virus either.
There have been things in the news about different mobile telephone networks not being able to interact with each other. And I think it's just the sheer volume of home working and people doing what we're doing now, conference calling over the internet.
Yes, for the benefit of our listeners who think we're all snugly tucked away together in a recording studio somewhere,
we're keeping our distance, very safe.
Yes, so our studio is split between Devon and Kent, so we never actually meet in person. So there's no risk of that virus being transferred during this podcast. Obviously, the coronavirus, COVID-19, is the news story, the only news story, it appears, on all the major networks at the moment. And much as I'd like to turn a blind eye to it and talk about something else, we are going to have to discuss it. And there are some relevant issues to construction here. There's a lot of speculation out there. We don't want to speculate necessarily about where this is taking the construction industry, but there are a few issues which have arisen this week as a result of Boris Johnson's advice and the actions of the government. Maybe you'd like to introduce that discussion, Phil, and tell us a little bit about what's been happening this week.
Essentially, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have, or particularly the Chancellor, has been saying to industries, look, we understand that some industries, front and centre, are now going to be in real trouble, places that absolutely rely on congregations of people gathering, like pubs and clubs and theatres and cinemas. The impact on other industries is harder to read, and he's asked all sorts of industries to say, look, tell us what you need us to do. We're here to help. We've got this big package of billions of pounds. Tell us what you need. And the Construction Leadership Council has written a letter co-signed by some of the big trade associations, Civil Engineering Contractors, Build UK, and the Federation of Master Builders. Their basic thing they're saying to the Chancellor or to the Prime Minister is, keep us open, please. As far as possible, as long as possible, let's keep construction sites going.
Yeah.
If that stops, there's just masses and masses of a huge chunk of the economy, a large workforce that is unable to work from home will just be out of work. A lot of those people are self-employed. The safest thing to do is to keep working as far as we can. Beyond that, well, you just have to wait and see. Try and keep the money flowing. Try and keep the government, you know, they're keen for the government clients, public sector clients, to make sure that they're paying promptly and to make sure that money's trickling down the supply chain so that whatever work is going on can go on.
Yeah.
And all the trade associations seem to be rallying around their members, trying to coordinate advice, legal advice, financial advice, to a lesser extent health advice, but welfare advice is probably a better way of putting it. And we're still at this stage where the risks are and the prospects are frightening, but relatively speaking, I mean, hardly anyone knows hardly anyone who's become seriously ill from this thing. So it's still early days, and we don't know how long it's going to go on.
I would have thought that construction, in many ways, was a little bit more resilient than many, for example, many office-based industries. The majority of actual construction work takes place out in the open air. Workers obviously do come into close contact with each other, but infrequently. Most people, you know, they're out there. They're probably wearing masks anyway. There's not close personal contact on a huge scale in construction, is there? I mean, obviously the back office there is, so that would have an effect. But I would have thought that a lot of building sites would be fairly safe places for people to go to work.
I take your point. I go along with that up to a point. I don't. It's not entirely clear whether there are any safe places.
Well, no. But I I was in Tesco yesterday, as per usual, along with everybody else. Apart from the absence of anything on the shelves, seemed like business as usual. Nobody was wearing a mask. Everybody was wandering around the aisles, looking rather bewildered with their trolleys. People sitting at the checkouts. So the supermarkets are having a difficult time because they're being rushed off their feet. The ironic thing is that the supermarkets are therefore packed all the time. So, I mean, surely that's going to be a huge risk for propagating the virus, as is, of course, our schools, because schools are still open. They haven't been closed yet. And I still don't understand how that can be protecting children against the coronavirus when they're all in there with their teachers. But, you know, if I look at construction, I think, well, compared to your average primary school or your average supermarket, it's yes. Probably a safer environment.
Yeah, no, I think from a virus point of view, you're absolutely right in that regard. But it's not, of course, it's not about stopping people getting ill. It's about flattening the curve, isn't it, that we've been told about, flattening the peak, and so that the hospitals can cope with, want the hospitals to be overloaded to a middling extent for a long time, rather than totally and utterly overloaded, can't cope for a lesser time.
Yes, it's a very complex issue. I know that the industry has sort of called on government, for example, to identify critical work on infrastructure projects that must go ahead, you know, to try and obviously minimise exposure, but optimise the workforce, I suppose. And so it's a bit of a balancing act. You know, they're appealing to the public and private sector to identify opportunities for suspending work, for example, and reviewing programmes and that kind of thing. So there's quite a lot which probably can be done to mitigate the impact.
There's a certain contradiction, I think, that comes to my mind, that if the government's having to borrow whatever it is, £330 billion or whatever the figure is, to bail out the economy, to bail out companies, industries from the mess that coronavirus is causing or threatens to cause, that's going to put the economy under a huge strain. Will it then have any money left or any borrowing power left to fund all its big infrastructure plans? On the flip side, we need the infrastructure plans to go ahead to get the economy out of the hole that it is heading into. And the other thing that strikes me about the huge amount of government spending, which, as Rishi Sunak said in his briefing yesterday, it's not about politics or ideology now. It's not a time for dogma or monetarism. It's we're now at war, folks, and we just have to do what we can.
Yeah.
Is if whole sectors of the economy are going to be in hock to the government, where does that leave the concept of a free market economy? I mean, it seems that no one's mentioned the word nationalisation yet, but in the same way that in the war times, the, you know, factories and munitions and so on were nationalised, and the railway stations and everything was nationalised and took a long time to be denationalised afterwards. I mean, ultimately, if things go on as they are, is that the direction of travel?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, you and I are lucky in that we haven't actually had to live through a period of warfare, really, you know, like our parents did, for example.
Not on home soil, anyway.
Not on home soil, no. It hasn't affected us to that extent. But, I mean, another manifestation of that is that manufacturers, private enterprises, have been appealed to by the government to help by... I thought it was a fascinating story. Rolls-Royce and JCB and Dyson, I think, were amongst the companies which have been approached by the government to see if they could start manufacturing ventilators, because of course, if we're going to be inundated with patients with severe respiratory infections, we're going to need an awful lot of respirators. And so the government's saying, would you be able to make these respirators for us, which is unprecedented in our lifetime, isn't it? I've never known anything like that happen before. JCB did put out a statement following that news, which said that they have been approached and they are willing, as a British firm, they're willing to do what they can to help the problem. But nothing definite as far as I know. But it does, I found that quite interesting. And it also made me wonder how on earth a company that makes enormous steel machines can suddenly switch its production to producing small, highly complex and rather fiddly ventilators. But I suppose needs must.
And I'm not even sure how much manufacturing or, you know, metal forming goes on at JCB and to what extent it's like a sort of a Nissan just-in-time component assembly line where they take things that are already made and they fit them together in the most efficient fashion.
It's a while since I was up at Roaster, but I mean, I think there is a lot of steel fabrication going on at JCB. I do think they make their own chassis and booms, you know, the components, and they make their engines. I don't know. They don't make those in Roaster, though. Yeah, they do. I mean, it's a big metal bashing operation up there. I did look into this a little bit. There was talk about how do you suddenly change your manufacturing setup to produce a completely different type of product. And you don't do it overnight is the short answer. It takes months because you've got to tool up. You need different tools. You've got to train your people to manufacture different products. You've got to, I mean, something like a ventilator is performance critical. I mean, it's keeping people alive. So you need to be able to provide warranties as to its performance. So it's a very complex situation. You know, you're making excavators and backhoe loaders one minute, and then the next you're making respirators. It doesn't happen like that. It would, if it were to happen, it would have to happen over an extended period of time.
My instinct is that a Hoover, a Dyson factory would be somehow a more appropriate place to make them than a Digger factory.
Yeah, me too. I mean, they're good at sucking things. I'm sure they could
sucking
blow
and blowing,
as well.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, you know, JCB is a adaptable firm. I'm sure they're a very dynamic outfit. I'm sure if any manufacturer could do it, they'd probably be able to do it. But
the other big side of this the virus story is the whole working from home thing, that the government have now said if you can work from home, if it's at all feasible, you should now do it.
Yeah.
Now we do tend to talk about the construction industry as people on the tools and the trades on site.
Yeah.
But of course, construction industry is much wider than that. There are an awful lot of people either driving around selling things or in offices aren't necessarily building things, but they're all part of the construction dynamic, construction whole circle of activity.
Yeah.
And many of those can and are now starting to work from home. And I think there's some firms will embrace this and find it no problem, who are already quite have flexible working patterns, and others that will find it, managers particularly, will find it terribly disconcerting not to be able to see the people that report to them.
And yes.
I started working from home much the same as you, and I went freelance, self-employed, more than 15 years ago. And while I suspected it would make me or bring out the lazy side of me, in fact, I found I got an enormous amount more done. I was getting literally twice as much work done. It took me half the time to research and write an article than it had done when I was sitting in an office, you know, drinking tea and having conversations over the photocopier or whatever. I got far more done. I also had 2 hours when I wasn't commuting there and back, and so the next 2 hours of the day. And I found that I was actually, instead of having a 7-hour productive working day, I was actually putting in a 9-hour day every day because it seemed appropriate to keep going till, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And I had a conversation with a colleague who was at the time working on a different magazine for a different publishing company. I said, do you know what? I don't know why you still work in the office. You would get so much more done if your bosses let you work from home. And he said, "Well, I've tried that. I've brought it up with them and mentioned that, but they don't trust us. You know, unless they can see the input, they're not going to judge us on output. They want to see the input." And
yes.
I think that is across all industries. I think there is a tendency to trust people on or judge people on presenteeism. On
yes, absolutely.
How yeah, long they're sitting at their desk and not on the actual work that gets done.
Well, I noticed that obviously people are, whenever they can, now working from home. And I think it was the Association of Consultancy in Engineering, ACE, recently asked, I think actually the government has responded already to their request quite independently. They've asked for, I think, a £50,000 grant to help their staff actually work from home. In other words, they want them to buy them laptops and mobile phones so they can work at home.
Yes, to be clear, this is not the association wanting the grants for its own staff, which is quite a small organisation.
No.
It's for its members, member firms, so civil engineering consultants
yes.
up and down the country who can't afford to splash out on laptops for everyone or whatever the particular software they need for.
Yes.
You say the government have responded to this already, have they?
Well, no, they've responded. No, they haven't really responded, but it's almost that request has been preempted by the fact that Rishi Sunak yesterday said that he was going to help SMEs and there would be this fund in order to make sure that companies didn't go bust as a result of this. So I imagine it amounts to the same thing. He's saying, yes, we will help you.
Money is available for whatever you need. Basically.
Money is available.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Whether or not it's the exact amount that the ACE has asked for, I don't know. But that's the sort of thing that's happening now. You know, people are having to learn to work in a different way.
And it may well be this is a permanent shift. So there may be companies who realise that actually it works just as well or better.
Yes.
And it is cheaper not to have office fulls of people in city centres with expensive real estate. There's already been as we've talked about previously, a movement towards flexible working, and everyone knows a movement towards home working. But this could be a transitional moment in all of that.
Yes, I think you're right, because obviously people tend to do what they've always done. And so if you're a design consultancy or an engineering consultancy, you'll have an office somewhere and your people will commute to and from the office. It's the way it's always done, and there is a
consuming carbon fuels as they do so mostly.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And there is, of course, a point of view that there's no substitute for face-to-face contact with somebody. You know, if you're part of a team, you have to be physically part of a team. You have to actually meet as a team. Well, we know that's not true, but a lot of firms have always operated like that, and they continue to operate that. If they're now obliged or compelled to change the way they work and to give people more independence and let them work from home, and as you say, if they discover that it actually works quite well, then yes, I'm sure that there will be a permanent shift, not wholesale, not 100%, because obviously people have got these offices and they expect people to occupy them still. But I think a lot of companies will realise that there is another way of doing things, and that might be, it might be a positive to come out of this after all the disruption and the pain.
The only trouble is so many of these new build houses haven't even got a room to swing a cat, never mind set up a desk and a computer.
What's next on the... we were talking about technology, weren't we?
Well, I think all the issues around coronavirus are going to be hogging the news, not just the national newspapers, but also on the constructionindex.co.uk for, I fear, many weeks to come, if not months.
Yeah.
So while that's going on, I'm trying my best to look around for some of the lighter or left field or more quirky stories to leaven the weight of virus.
Yeah, we like that.
Oh, we've had two or three this week that have come in. Have you seen it? Have anyone caught your eye? Yeah,
nice techie stories. Yes, I have. I like this sort of thing. I think it's, as you say, it's quirky, but it's also, I mean, it's not frivolous. These are,
it's also
these
are basically the future.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking about sort of technological innovations, maybe small steps, but innovations which you can see a lot of potential for the future in. The one which caught my eye specifically in the last week was this one about, I think, an Israeli firm. I can't remember its name. I've got it written down somewhere.
You're talking about Build Dots.
That's right, yeah. They've developed...
I wonder if Build Dot was any relation to Gal Gadot.
Well, we'll have to ask somebody about that. When I saw this, I thought basically you're turning your site workers into Google Street View cameras, because basically it's a 360 degree camera which you wear on the top of your hard hat, and it's BIM enabled. So it's building information modeling. You link it to a server via various apps, and this 360 degree camera basically records your environment as you walk around the site. So it will basically give you a real-time picture, literally, of what's going on site. So when you're doing your rounds every day, you'll get a visual record of it. But it's not just that. It will, using these algorithms, it can connect to the project's BIM model, and it can actually compare the reality of the site with the plan. So basically, if the chap's walking around the site, he doesn't even have to clock it, but if, for example, there's a whole several square meters of cladding which isn't there and should be there, that will be picked up by the BIM model. Or if there's something else which is going on which perhaps shouldn't be happening at that particular time.
Do we know if his helmet sounds an alarm and starts flashing when it sees something wrong?
I don't think it does.
Not to that stage.
I think it's fairly passive. I don't know how. I mean, presumably the chap wearing the hat isn't actually the operator. He doesn't control it. He's not, probably not even looking at a tablet with the BIM model on it, although I suppose he could be.
Oh, I thought it was a specific site manager, investigator who had to put on the camera and go around and point his camera at everything. I thought it was more of an active process of
oh, is it? Right, okay, well, I
misunderstood
it in all that case. Okay.
I mean, outside of construction site, you don't really see anyone in the helmet without some sort of GoPro camera or similar on top of it.
That's true.
A motorbike, yeah, or a pair of skis or a skateboard or whatever. They've all got, you know, their GoPro cameras to capture their life experience to go on their social media feed or for whatever purpose.
Yeah. Yeah,
But I think this is less about just generically giving everyone on site a BIM enabled camera. It's a more, at this stage, at any rate, I think it's more specific. It's you know, yeah. Oh, you've got the camera, you've got to go out and photograph everything, just walk around, which almost suggests a bit of a gimmick, putting it on the hard hat rather than just holding it. But but it doesn't seem a huge leap to therefore move on in the near future to exactly what you're talking about, where, yeah, just everyone routinely has a camera on their hard hat or on their lapel, like traffic officers do or whatever.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Just pick everything up.
Well, it's obviously useful. I mean, in a way, it's perhaps behind the curve, because, as you've pointed out, police often have body cams, and extreme sports enthusiasts routinely use a GoPro to record what they're doing. So this is an extension of that, I suppose. But I think it's the idea that it's analogous to the Google Street View camera that
it
combines that.
It's the interface with the BIM records back in HQ, yes, or whatever, and the records will be automatically updated. I mean, that's the clever stuff. They're just making pictures is old tech now.
I think, is this what they call the Internet of Things? We old fogies probably don't understand what the Internet of Things are, but that's what I assume that it is. It's interconnecting things, different systems, to make them work together and sort of to their mutual advantage. I thought that was a very interesting development. I think it'd be interesting to see how that takes off and what contribution it can make.
I think that's the sort of thing which could make construction more efficient and more accurate. But I think more urgent was a different tool which we covered in the past few days, which is a smart glove. And you only need to wear one of these, yes, a la Madonna or Michael Jackson or whatever. You wear one of these gloves and it measures the vibration going through into your hand and your arm from the power tool or the compactor or the whatever it is that you're holding. Now, hand-arm vibration, sometimes known as white finger, because the symptom that manifests is your fingers turn white, is it's been known about for ages that power tools, excessive use of power tools, will it can damage the nerves in your fingers and your hands and your arms. The health and safety executive reckon about 2 million UK workers at any one time at risk from excessive vibration-related diseases in their mostly in their hands. And there's something like 3,000 litigation claims for industrial injuries a year. And big, big money fines have been coming down in recent years. Balfour Beatty was fined £500,000 in 2018. And Housing Association, but their Housing Association, but Places for People Homes, 600,000 last year. So, and there have been other cases of councils where for years they'd had their grounds maintenance crew out with their leaf blowers, lawnmowers, whatever, and the crews would be using these power tools all day, every day.
Yeah.
And it's only become a relatively recent thing that legislation said, no, hang on a minute, you've got to monitor, measure, manage the exposure of your workers to the risk of this disease, they call it, condition of hand-arm vibration syndrome. Anyway, there have been various tools, gadgets, gizmos that have been developed to measure exposure to hand-arm vibration. You can put a little...
It's quite a complicated issue, isn't it? Because it's to do with... I think all hand tool manufacturers or power tool manufacturers now have to actually test and calibrate their equipment and then declare...
A safe working limit.
It's to do with acceleration, isn't it, of the vibration. And there's a certain dosage which is measured in sort of the number of minutes or hours that you can do it. So if you've exposed yourself, take a hammer drill, for example, it'll be rated... have a certain rating so that you will only be able to use that for a certain number of hours a day before you say you've had your maximum dose and you've got to stop using it. So tool manufacturers have been required to fall in line, but this is different, this glove, isn't it? Because
measuring devices which you put on the body or the handle of the tool that actually measures the vibration, but that only measures that tool. As you go from tool to tool, it might be different. But this glove that's been developed and is on trial on a live site in Coventry, you put the glove on, and that measures how much risk, how much vibration you're exposed to, whether you're using a grinder, drill, breaker, whatever. The glove will. I don't quite know who it talks to, whether it sends you a message in a text phone or whether it turns pink, but somehow the glove will alert the operative, the wearer of the glove, that you need to take a break now. You've reached the safe limit. Go do something else. Don't have to have a cup of tea, take a break. You can be, go carry some one load across the site or something. So it doesn't mean you have to stop working. It just means you have to change task.
It's a British firm that's developed this, isn't it? It's actually, you said it's being trialled in Coventry. It's a Coventry-based firm. We ought to give them a name check. Ferraru Dynamics, are they called? Something like that.
Right, I've got to spell F for Ferraru, E-R-A-R-U, Ferraru, which is... And it's being used by Callan Connect, a contractor I'm not familiar with, but a Coventry contractor who's doing cable laying for City Fibre, putting down...
Well, I imagine it's broadband connections and that kind of thing. So it'd be interesting. I think they've only just started the trial, haven't they? And they're two or three of their site operatives are using it, presumably with breakers, handheld breakers. I imagine that is the main threat.
Yes, they're trenching, aren't they? But there's another one, a Scottish company last year we reported on called Reactech, who developed a similar kind of concept, but this was a wristwatch. Instead of counting your steps, it counts the vibration, and this is the same thing. And what they can do is the information that it is gathered can go back to a central platform on the computer where you can at the end of the day, week, year, you've got a whole spreadsheet of exactly who's been exposed to how much, you know, what, why and when. And I think the reason why it's particularly important for employers to embrace these sort of tools is that when a legal case does come, they've got to demonstrate that they've done everything reasonable. In effect, put the onus back on the employee, saying, "Well, actually, we told the employee they shouldn't do this. We gave them the tools so that they didn't have to do this. And if they've done it, it's their fault, not our fault, Gov."
Yeah,
Is a great incentive, I think, for employers to get good technology to protect their employees.
The other techie story, which I really liked, which is a similar sort of idea, it's to try and minimise the harmful musculoskeletal injuries.
Which is an even bigger threat, less severe, but even bigger threat. Musculoskeletal injuries are bigger in construction than vibration white finger.
Yes, indeed.
Huge issue.
Well, I wouldn't have thought, I must admit, this is me betraying my ignorance, I wouldn't have thought that people would need any assistance raking blacktop into a pothole. But I've never had to do it, luckily, so I don't know how difficult it is. I imagine that hot loose asphalt is actually quite difficult stuff to shift around manually with a rake, but it is.
Well, now there's help. Help is at hand. Help is at hand. But the back-breaking work of raking asphalt can now be done with, we've called it a bionic rake somewhat cheekily. It's actually, they call it the ExoPush. A French company, Kerolas, is also big in the UK, and they developed this with one of their suppliers in France, and they brought it to the UK. It looks like a big rake, but rather in the same way that if you have a particularly meaty strimmer that you'll wear a harness and strap it onto yourself when you're strimming the grass.
Yeah,
it's got a strap on to yourself contraption for the rake, and along with that has got an electric actuator which somehow helps push or pull the rake so that you're not having to apply all the force. So you act on it, apply 10% of force, and you get back more force, 90% of force that you get. I mean, all this sort of technology, it started in, it was driven by car manufacturers. A lot of it came out of Detroit with the car manufacturers, with things called air balancers, where you're on an assembly line and you're perpetually lifting something which is not a particularly heavy load, but if you're doing it all day, every day, hundreds of times, it can be, tiresome, taxing, strain-inducing load. And they created these electro-pneumatic things which were on the devices that fitted to the bottom of overhead cranes. So you could pick something up and using one of these balancers and it would be miraculously weightless. And you could move these components around. And from that, we've had other developments, again, born out of the motor industry where there's an awful lot of repetitive lifting on the assembly lines. And we've reported,
we had a feature last
October.
Last year. Yeah.
Helena Russell,
yes, I believe
it was.
That's right.
And it was
about exoskeletons.
Yeah, very, very comprehensive.
Powered exoskeletons.
We've reported bibs and bobs about how, I think Wilmot Dixon in 2018 tried an exoskeleton from a US company, ExoBionics, and then Morrison Utility Services have had a go on it. Amy, maintenance staff on the Forth Bridge, have tried it. But there are similar and variations, difference on all these sort of robotic or devices to actuator springs to make heavy things lighter or to support the body in its movement. But Helena's article last October pulled all of these different bits and pieces that we've been talking about over the past couple of years together in one place. So I recommend that. I mean, that's available on the constructionindex.co.uk website. If you look for magazines, you can find back issues, October 2019. And you can read all about these bionic assistance devices. I don't know whether we're going to see them, get them beyond the quirky test ideas. I mean, do you think they're going to How far away are they going to be, do you think, David?
Well, I think you put your finger on it when you said that they are useful for these repetitive actions. So when you're doing the same thing, you can imagine somebody on a production line having to fit a hydraulic motor to something as it goes past on the production line, basically doing the same action time and time again. In construction, I don't know if that happens quite so much. People are a little bit more mobile, aren't they? I can imagine something like raking hot asphalt probably is. You're doing the same
thing. But there's an awful lot of storehouse kind of tasks in construction. I mean, construction isn't just about things. It's about logistics and getting materials to the right place in the right quantities and so on. So we're not just talking about plastering and putting up plasterboard or whatever.
No. I think that these machines, though, would tend to limit your mobility because they're designed to assist you doing a particular function and to magnify a specific movement. Like, for example, if you look on the Construction Index website and have a look at the story about this exo push, you can see it's actually strapped to your leg. You can't sort of stop doing what you're doing very easily and just walk off and do something else. You are actually strapped into this thing. So, yes, I can't imagine, for example, even though it's a repetitive business, I can't imagine a bricklayer using something like this because they have to move. You know, they're moving around a little bit more. So I think it has its place, and I think they will be used. I'd be interested to see if Colas concludes that this is worth pushing out to their entire workforce, but I think it has to be an appropriate type of application. It's not suitable for everything.
Well, you mentioned the article. Mentioned that article in the last October's issue of the magazine, but another issue of Construction Index magazine landed on my doorstep this week, David. The March 2020 issue.
Yes,
looks a good job. Full of interesting stuff.
We are now available in selected newsstands, WH Smith's, and various regional news agents. It's in the shops, on the newsstands, on the 16th of every month. So, we've got a big feature on rail construction. That's the main course, if you like. We've got a 7-page feature looking at obviously HS2, which is the big rail industry story at the moment, looking at what that has in store for the industry and what it might contribute. Of course, everything is subject to coronavirus, of course, so I hope we're not already out of date, but yes, HS2 is the big story. But we're also looking at other rail projects around the country which probably haven't had as much publicity because of the size and the dominance of HS2. The East-West rail line is another project that is happening, apparently. This is the project to connect Oxford and Cambridge. But, I think £500 million has been earmarked for reconnecting towns whose services were scrapped by the Beeching Review. Other projects...
I just wanted to interrupt. So the feature article that caught my eye in the magazine this month was about the skill shortage, which is normally something. Skill shortage. Of course, there's always been a skill shortage. It's always a problem. what new can we find to say about it? It's an important subject, hard to make sound interesting. And there've been an awful lot of things said in recent years that the way to get young people in industry is to tell them it's not all bricklaying and electricians and plumbers, that construction is much more dynamic than that, that there's lots of high-tech stuff and there's BIM and there's...
Yes.
It doesn't have to be dirty and on-site. There's lots of off-site modern methods of manufacturing. And to sell them the brave new world of the modern world of construction.
And yes, walk around the site with a BIM hat on.
This is how we get young people into the construction industry. We get them in at the modern end of things.
Yes.
And it turns out English Heritage is concerned that they've got no one to look after all these fabulous old buildings that they're trying to look after.
Yeah.
All the traditional skills. We still need them. We do still need masons and carpenters who can carve wood. Old heritage skills, and this is an issue for English Heritage, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. This is an article written by Hannah Prowse, and so I'll quote you a figure or two here. There's a they reckon this Pi Tate report reckoned that there was about 6,500 people working in built heritage. But that related only to those in the operation of historic sites and buildings. So those are the landmark projects that we all know about, the historic buildings. And the so-called, the people working in what we would regard as the construction industry in general, just working on older buildings, nobody knows how many people there are doing that or how equipped they are with the correct skills. So, carpenters, plasterers, bricklayers, all these traditional skills, which I think in recent years, probably in the last 50 years, have become regarded as perhaps a little bit old-fashioned and specialist. They're actually sort of basic skills. They're not specialist.
I don't see that changing, though. I don't see these traditional artisan skills becoming part of the syllabus of training courses anytime in the future. I think the drive towards promoting off-site and high-tech and everything will continue. But what you'll end up with is specialist boutique firms who make it their business to be centres of excellence, I think, for,
yes,
which we already see to a certain extent. If when they put out the Palace of Westminster job or the subcontract packages, if you know the market, that there are only two or three firms in each field that are going to be in with a shout for any one of those packages, because that's their kind of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
But I think we've just about hit the end of the road for this week, David.
I think so, yes. As I said, the magazine is out now. If you can, as long as the government hasn't prevented you from going into your local WH Smith, you can probably go in and buy a copy. But yes, I think that's it for today. So do you want to sign us off then, Phil?
Well, just to say thank you, everyone, for tuning in, listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at all the usual podcast subscribing locations. You can contact us, email podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Your feedback is always welcome. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagents UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.